I certainly think that Rounder Records and therefore Ken Irwin are in that legend category. I hope you listened to last week's program. We delved into a little bit with Ken Irwin, the founding, the guiding principles of Rounder Records in its infancy. Today we're going to conclude that discussion in the second hour. We'll talk a little bit more about the modern, I won't say the modern state of music, just some observations about what's going on in music in general. Please stay tuned. You're going to enjoy hearing the second part of Ken Irwin discuss Rounder music and just some observations from Ken about music in general. And who better to ask?
Really happy to sit and chat with Ken Irwin. I've gotten to know you, I will say, at least to be familiar with you from Gray Fox and also from my tenure on the board at IBMA. And let's not do big, broad picture, future pictures of Bluegrass and IBMA, but what do you have thoughts about music as it exists today, knowing what you witnessed through the Rounder evolution and maybe where some things are now?
Well, we've certainly seen changes. We've seen the changes in repertoire, which is we've seen a change in terms of the sources of material, in terms of, I was thinking, I mean, mentioned repertoire, I mean, going outside. Last night we heard people doing Grateful Dead music, and many other sources. We've heard country songs being taken into bluegrass, where, of course, bluegrass was viewed as a part of country when it first started.
That's right.
Bluegrass, I think the term is usually referred to as first being used in 1957 or so, where the music is said to begin around 1945 for many people.
Okay.
We've seen the entrance and success of women in bluegrass, which we did have a Rose Maddox record. We did have Hazel and Alice. We did have, as I said, Wilma Lee Cooper, but it was really the exception rather than the rule. And now most people, especially here, if you take a look at the schedule, it's there's a woman in many of the groups and often leading the groups.
Do you think that, let me ask you this, do you think that Gray Fox, I believe it comes clearly from the top down, that there is a feel here of, you know, let's say we've gone through some rain, difficult times. They're always ready to adapt, and they're always ready to react to what's going on. And it seems to be, to me, the most, I won't say that everything is with a hug, but at least the mentality is let's work this out and let's get through it and let's go through whatever and get the. I always feel this feeling up here that it's we're all together, we're all going to make this work. I mean, am I the only person that feels that way?
I think that's true, but I think that the festival has changed over the last few years with Claire Armbruster doing the booking, and it feels more like a bluegrass festival. There's still a tremendous breadth, but the acts playing here are really representative of virtually all things happening in bluegrass.
Yeah.
It's a it's a bluegrass showcase, and
and
it has that breadth so that anybody who might enjoy almost any kind of bluegrass, they'll find something here.
And this was with your Rounder, with the early days of Rounder, I often would get, and this would open another window for me as I got a new Rounder record. I would look at the sources, which I love, liner notes, which I hate the fact that they're disappearing more and more and more, but I would find another. So I would think people maybe come here and see an act and figure they drew resources and information from another thing, and they could go back. And I think that's part of it. You collect it all and string it together somehow. And festivals, I think, allow the audience to, if they want to, connect those dots back to the sources that are being played. I think that's what happens.
To some degree.
Yeah.
I mean,
I hope it happens.
Yeah. And it's nice when the artist refer on stage where they got the music.
Yes.
And I think that there's something going on now, which is different. There are many artists who didn't have contact with any of the first generation people.
Good point.
And it's getting to the point where there are fewer second generation people out.
You're right.
And often hear people playing a Stanley Brothers tune and say, I got this from David Parmalee.
That's right. You're right.
And even back then, it was like, oh, we got this from the Bluegrass Cardinals.
Yeah.
And maybe they got it from the Bluegrass Cardinals.
Right. No, you're right. Yeah. That's a good point. You're right. Because I recognize the sources that they're playing, but you're right, because sometimes their sources are 10 or 15, 20 years ago.
And when they're doing that song, it's sort of like that game of telephone. So if you're hearing a Stanley Brothers tune interpreted by the Bluegrass Cardinals,
that's right,
and then they take it to another level, each time there's a change, and likely getting further from the roots of that music.
Yeah, I don't see any way around that, though. I don't see how that's not going to happen.
Well, I think it will happen, but if the artist performing now give the proper references or credit, that enables people to go
but
back.
But if they don't know them,
in another world, when the Rolling Stones came out, they talked about their sources, their influences,
right.
And not only that, they had them very frequently open for them.
Right, that's right.
And George Thorogood, when he came on the scene, he opened a bunch of dates for the Rolling Stones, but he also made sure that a lot of the blues artists that influenced him and who he claims he got into business to open for them,
right,
he had them open for him later on as a tribute. And always refers to those artists so that the inquisitive person will say, he got that from Hound Dog Taylor.
Yeah.
Now, who's Hound Dog Taylor? Great name, but who would
look him up. Yeah.
Yeah. And
that's the fun.
And there are people now, if somebody mentions the Stanley Brothers or a lesser known act, Glenn Neves, or Connie and Babe, there are certain people who will go back and check them out, Google them or find early recordings, and others who won't. They just, don't have the interest, don't have the inquisitive approach.
And there's nothing you can do about that.
No.
There's nothing
and
you can do about that.
That's up to them.
Right.
I know one of the interesting little sidebars on that is that I actually started working with a band partially from correcting them on a reference where they mentioned that, I think it was You Can Have Her, came from Waylon Jennings, and they might have heard it from J.D. Crow, but they were trying to go back.
That's right, yeah.
And I sent them an email and said, no, comes from Roy Brown. And that started a dialogue.
Yeah,
And somewhat led to our working with them.
Can I talk about one more topic? I've probably used more time than you want to give me.
Time.
We've talked about the Rounder. Of course, they were LPs and vinyl then, and then the CDs. But what's going on with this recorded music now? It's changing so fast, but, I mean, what do you think about recordings of music and the availability of those things? That's where it's all changes daily.
It changes daily, and it's had a major impact on record labels, but it also does on artists. Stan Zadonik, who was the head of the board at IBMA for years and on the board for many years before that, is a professor in computer stuff, and he works Grass Union, and he became concerned as CD sales were dropping off, as people were buying one song online or buying a whole song online, but you know, in some cases just streaming and not buying anything, that the artists were not selling as much music, and therefore they would be asking more money from him when he was booking the Joe Val Festival.
Okay.
And so he was trying to come up with ideas where the artist's music could be available at the Joe Val Festival, and people could get it on flash drive or some other mechanism that people could buy music from the artist, and the artist would still be able to make money as they had when they sold CDs. At, you know, at Grey Fox, you still see lines of people buying CDs, but they're not as long as they used to be.
My prediction, not a prediction, but I stop in stores that would be normally have CDs back home, and there's almost no shelf space devoted to carrying, and the variety has always been cut back. I'm thinking a year and a half, there won't be shelf space for CDs, and the only way you're going to get them is at a show that an artist brings them to. And that, how's that going to impact the effort to record an entire CD and make it available? And then how's that going to impact, if there was ever a theme to an album, where's the theme to a single? And then what's going to happen?
Well, one of the interesting aspects of this is that most of the majority of people that are streaming are younger, and the bluegrass audience has not been a traditionally young audience. And I think the bluegrass audience was among the last to give up on cassettes and 8-tracks and LPs.
8-tracks. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I mean, they could sell 8-tracks in Florida years after no one was making them.
Right. I get it.
But, you know, there's that concern going forward that there's a period of time where this younger audience that's streaming is not necessarily buying music, and yet the streaming numbers are not significant enough to really be a serious revenue stream. So, you know, one of the positive aspects of the changes is Sound Exchange.
Yes.
And Sound Exchange was set up by the U.S. government, and it provides royalties for performance. But unfortunately, that would be on cable and other digital, but it does not still pay royalties for AM or FM radio, terrestrial radio. So to use I guess we could use a somewhat bluegrass example. I usually use Aretha Franklin and R-E-S-P-E-C-T, but we could do Alison Krauss and When You Say Nothing at All. And, you know, the question is, how much money did Alison Krauss make for all of that radio airplay on When You Say Nothing at All, which topped off at number 2 on the country chart?
Yeah.
And the answer is?
I don't know the answer.
0.
Really?
The artist does not get paid for the publisher, and in turn the songwriter gets paid for terrestrial radio.
Yeah.
But the artist, and that, When You Say Nothing at All was a wonderful song, is a wonderful song, but a major part of why that record did as well as it did was because of Alison's performance.
Yes.
And after all, the record had been released by Keith Whitley.
Correct.
Another very good singer.
True.
But it was Alison's version of it that propelled the album up to up there and the song up there.
Yeah.
And yes, you can say she got more gigs and she probably got a higher fee, but nothing from AM or FM radio.
Yeah.
And a number of us have gone to Washington and tried to lobby, or have lobbied. One of my partners, Marion Levy, actually testified in front of Congress about this. And nothing's changed. So it's where the Sound Exchange money that's coming in is very helpful, and sometimes it's, in some cases, more money comes in from Sound Exchange than from record sales these days. And we, as a label, have to look differently when we're trying to figure out if we're going to record an act. We have to look not only at the record sales, but at the Sound Exchange to see if we can make things work financially. And, it's a great help to the artist, but I've been disappointed that the bluegrass world hasn't been more active in terms of trying to lobby, because the Spotify figures mean nothing.
Right.
You hear about people who have millions of Spotify hits,
right,
and, and making whatever it is, $99 for millions of hits, and bluegrass, again, with an older audience, isn't getting anywhere near those numbers. So the bluegrass artists and record companies and managers and people who depend on the artists making a good living really could use that additional help. And we're one of three countries. I think we're with, like, North Korea and Iran or something like that.
That almost doesn't
only
sound
company.
Good. That
no.
almost doesn't sound good yeah. when you start the premise off as it's us and North Korea and Iran.
Yeah, and then...
Nothing can go to
work. And then because we don't have it, there's a lack of reciprocity because we're not collecting for people from other countries.
Other artists.
So when, in most countries where they're collecting money, but it's not coming back here because we're not sending them money.
Wow. Yeah, it's a constantly changing landscape. I'm really glad that people like you are still on top of it, Ken, from Rounder, because I know you're still...
Well, we're trying to
you're
be.
You're trying
yeah,
to be, and that's all you can do. I mean,
yeah.
And I appreciate everything you've always done for music. I've said that already, but I love the fact that here as we're sitting, you've given me... I've taken more time than we wanted to do, but I had other questions. That you're still watching and observing and paying attention to music and the process of getting it out to people to listen to, and that you're still, thankfully, you're still vitally involved in the whole process that I want to see succeed. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thanks, Ken.
Well, thank you.